So for this talk, we move to the next factor in liberative dependent arising. And we're getting close to the end. So on one hand, I'd like to say that what I'm going to talk about is sometimes considered to be fairly, it's things that happen when practice gets fairly developed and mature. On the other hand, I'd like to say that's something that is happening all along in the practice, and that you might not recognize it, but from the very beginning, this factor is present. The Pali word is viraga, V-I-R-A-G-A, and it's usually translated in two different ways. And there's many Pali words that don't lend themselves to a single English word, and so translators will translate them differently depending on the context. And I'd like to offer those two meanings, talk about them, but I also want to mention a third way of translating it that is not what the word exactly means, but probably carries the same valence, the same kind of emotional connection in ancient India as the English word has, and maybe in some places in modern America. So the new translation that I like to offer is freedom. And now we're starting to get at this point in the practice, we're starting to get a clear sense of feeling for freedom, or the dawn of freedom. That freedom is on its way, or is developing, or growing. And so freedom here is not the all or nothing, but a movement into greater and greater freedom. The most common translation is dispassion. And a little problematic for modern colloquial English, where for some people, passion is all good. You should have a passion for life and do the things you have a passion for. Where it means things that you have your wholehearted for, you put your heart into. More traditionally, passion comes from the Latin word suffering. So, to say you should do what you have a passion for doesn't mean do what you want to what you suffer for. But that's kind of the original meaning of the word. It's kind of slowly morphed into its modern colloquial meanings. But it also means really intense desire. Some people will translate it as lust. And if we take lust to be intense desire, like the lust for power, lust for money, not just a lust for sex, but just more broadly, it probably captures some of these meanings, ancient meanings of viraga. It's the fading away. It's the ending of this very powerful compulsive desires that people have, that we can have. The other translation is fading away. This represents very nicely one way in which we mature in this practice. It's the way we get fading away is the word raga, R-A-G-A, which can mean passion. It can also mean the dye with which you dye clothes, cloth. And if you put the cloth in the sun for a while, or it gets older, the color begins to fade away. And that fading away is one meaning for viraga. So some translators will translate viraga as a fading away, and a fading away of intense raga, fading away of this intense, compulsive, strong desires, cravings that we might have. And so it's a shift in how the grip that desires have on us. When desires have a strong grip on us, we might say there's the desires are there in an intense way or in a passionate way, maybe. Or you could say that they're in a... But then as practice matures and develops, that intensity of that desire begins to fade. So rather than just switching flipping a switch and the desire just goes, part of practice, it involves the slow, steady fading away, dissolving of some of this intense attachments we have, intense desires, including desires for, hostility, being hostile, hateful. So yesterday Inez talked about disenchantment, and disenchantment has mostly to do with the object of our desires, and we see those objects in a new way, such that we no longer enamored with them or enchanted by them. And Inez used the example of the magician, that an audience won't tire watching a magic trick if they don't know how the trick is done. It's enchanting. But as soon as they're shown how it's done, then they don't need to see it anymore. It's not so alluring or captivating or wowing. So what happens there is that the audience, if they know how the trick is done, are no longer enchanted. They start to get disenchanted with the object, with the trick. But also what's happened is that their desire to see the trick being done fades away. And the fading away is talking about what's happening from the point of view of the subject, the person, what shifts in them. Whereas the disenchantment has to do, it is a disenchantment we have, but it's more having to do, and it's more like an understanding of what's out there. It's more like a relationship to something. We're disenchanted. We might have a lot of desires, and a lot of them are intense. But then, lo and behold, we discover that that one of the objects of one of our desires no longer is, we get disenchanted by it. So we have this wonderful candy bar we like, and it's just so good to eat it, until we find out that the magic ingredient is cockroaches, ground up cockroaches. So, so immediately we're disenchanted, maybe. I don't know about you, probably I would be. I don't think I want that candy anymore. But in addition, from another point of view, my desire for that candy fades away. So it's kind of like sometimes, said to be two sides of the same coin, kind of these two, disenchantment and dispassion. And we're fading away. And I love the translation fading away, because it's not a magical thinking. It's not like, somehow there's a big bang theory about enlightenment. If I just get that big bang, great cosmic light opens up and swallows me or something, then I'll be happy ever after. Enlightenment is the ultimate happy ever after. That's it. It'd be just like, now I can go into my wonderful enlightened retirement. It's important to get enlightened, but you want to do it quickly because there's all these great things to do in life and you want to get on with it and do them. There's a very touching story that I've only been told. I wasn't there, but I was told by people who were there, of the Dalai Lama in Arizona. It's a big auditorium giving a teaching. And there was a Q&A time, and someone stood up to the microphone to ask the Dalai Lama a question. And the person asked for the fastest way to enlightenment. And the Dalai Lama paused for a very long time, just stood, didn't say anything. And for the people who were close enough, after a while, They see that he was crying. There were tears coming down his cheek. And then finally, when he spoke, he said, maybe I'm making a little bit this up, but he said something like that how sad it was to have this desire to be enlightened as quickly as you can. So exactly what he was thinking about, I don't know, but maybe he saw there was a greed in that. Maybe he was afraid of bypass, spiritual bypasses. Maybe he saw it as there is not a lot of wisdom that grows then. A lot of the wisdom has to do with really understanding this human condition and going through all the different challenges, or many of the challenges of human life, not all of them, but enough to really understand. And I can see it in myself that how I understood people and their suffering when I was a new teacher 30 years ago is a lot different than it is now, because of this slow process of maturation continued as I was a teacher, experiencing all kinds of aspects of life and challenging aspects of life. And so there was a slow growing and development and slow fading away. Certainly there's all kinds of things that faded away in these last 30 years of attachments to self, self-conceits of different kinds. Maybe some of them had to do with being a teacher. And being a teacher is a great way to have be disenchanted with being a teacher. And, you know, that's somehow special or something. And so I feel very grateful for these last 30 years and feel a little bit, regrets about maybe some of the things I told people 30 years ago. When I didn't understand how difficult their challenges were. So this idea of getting enlightened quickly, maybe it's nice, but maybe then you won't be able to help people very much, support people. You want to go through a process of maturation and development and growth. And the challenge you have, maybe, just maybe, it's what's going to serve you in the future. To support someone else, will help you understand someone. You don't know what you're being asked to do. You don't know what you'll be asked to do. You don't know how you're growing and developing in this whole process. And so I know this is no magical thinking, but rather this steady, slow process that can be understood in different perspectives. And one of them is this perspective of the liberative dependent arising. One of the challenges of teaching this teaching is not to give the impression that this is only to be understood as a linear progression. And you were supposed to just follow along each day when we talked about the subject. You're either supposed to have been there already that day, or the next day you were supposed to catch up. And, you know, you're supposed to follow along. And because it's a progressive, and of course you want to kind of follow the progress, and you want to be, you want to be doing it right somehow. Another way of understanding it is that it's not so much progressive as it is that each of the factors of the liberative dependent arising contains all the others, except for the first one, suffering. But suffering is like the on-ramp to the freeway. Suffering is what gets you up to the freeway, with suffering, there's 12 steps in dependent arising. And so maybe it's a maybe it's a 12-lane freeway that you get on. And you kind of go back and forth between different lanes, depending on what's going on. Sometimes you need to kind of be in in the far right lane, sometimes far left lane, sometimes in the middle. Depends what's happening with the traffic and where it stopped up ahead, and you move over and switch around. And sometimes you're in the commuter lane, and that looks really great until you realize you're driving alone. Uh-oh, I left people behind. And so anyway, or it's like a school that has 11 subjects. And, you know, you're studying all 11 every grade as you grow up. But, you know, 1 hour is devoted to one, then another hour is devoted to another. And so you go back and forth, but they're all kind of growing and you're developing together. So, you know, if the idea is liberation at the end, even liberation is there in some small way with faith. Because with faith, we're no longer completely mired in the world of suffering. There's a glimmer of light, of direction, and we're no longer so stuck in the suffering that we can't practice. Now we have faith that there's a practice. Maybe we haven't even started practicing, but we have faith. And that faith frees us a little bit from the stuckness in the suffering. It opens up space. Maybe there's hints of gladness in the faith. There's hints of each step along the way. And then as we go along, some of them expand and become bigger and more prominent, but we get into that lane on the freeway, and the others maybe get smaller or recede. When we get up to dispassion, maybe the faith lane is really small, but there's still some faith, but faith is not that important anymore. Because we have, you know, we don't need to have faith that this works. it's working right under our feet. It's like it's in the, you know, it's like, you know, you don't have to, like if you're walking someplace and you're strong and capable and walking, you know, down the block, you know, you don't really need to think about having faith anymore. You just walk down the block. So with disenchantment and dispassion, the whole process is unfolding. And so faith fades away. And so much so that eventually one of the things that fades away entirely at the end of this whole process is faith itself. And there's one place in the suttas where the Buddha says this provocative thing. I think it meant to be provocative even back then. It says that an arhat, someone who's fully enlightened, is faithless, which, you know, doesn't sound so good in English, and I don't think it sounded good in Pali either. But it was kind of a provocative statement that they don't need to have faith anymore. If you have faith that you can walk down the block to the neighbor's house down there, and then you arrive at the house, sitting in their living room. You no longer need to have faith you're going to get there. I mean, that's you know, to sit there on the couch at their house, yep, I have faith I can get to the house. I have faith I can get to the house. You know, it's just a waste of time. You want to be with your friends. So faith has this functional use that fades as this practice matures and matures. And so this idea that there's these 11 lanes, we can find ourselves going back and forth in different lanes at different times, because maybe that's the lesson. That's where we're maturing and growing in at any given time. And then we're still traveling on the road, but we switch lanes. And sometimes we have to go back all the way to faith, in a sense, because that's where can say that's where the lesson is, that's where we grow. Say another way, it turns out maybe if faith is a slow lane on the freeway, sometimes a slow lane is the fastest when there's a lot of traffic. And so who knows what the fast and slow is, but so there's a kind of a fluidity and going back and forth and a contentment to be with what is up right now. And there's no real need to think of yourself, where am I on, how far have I gotten? And be like a little kid in the back seat who tells their parents, am I there yet? Am I there yet? There's no need for that. Just where you are is probably the right place. And that'll shift and change over time. So viraga, the fading away of intense desire, the fading away of unwholesome desire, the fading away of the kind of desires and aversions that are stressful to have, the kind of desires which are uncomfortable to have, that are stressful to have, that are that really, in a sense, doesn't really work for us, doesn't support us. And so when we start seeing things as they are and starting having a glimpse of what freedom is like, letting go is like, that gives us a chance to begin understanding better and better how, what mental states and what mental ways of being are healthy for us and which are not. And we start becoming highly sensitive to the unhealthy states of mind, the ones that are stressful, the ones that are painful, the ones that are fatiguing, the ones that are separating, alienating, the ones that make us smaller, contract us. And we become more sensitive also to the ones that expand us, that free us, that nourish us, that support us. And so this being able to see that, and then the ones that are unhealthy, the desires, to begin to let them fade away, to begin to let them kind of recede, and not to be enchanted by them, but also not give them so much authority and value. And so there is, in this path of liberation, there comes a time where both a natural process of fading away happens on its own. And you'll notice after a time, after a while, that you're no longer interested in some of the things you're interested in before. And there wasn't exactly a decision. It was more like, wow, you know, I'm not doing that anymore. That doesn't seem to serve me, or doesn't grab me. But also, this fading away involves a decision. Sometimes we see this doesn't serve. This is not healthy. This is not useful. And I think I'm ready to give it up. To see that drinking alcohol is actually detrimental and really seeing it clearly enough, then enough, I'm going to stop this. To see that watching TV for 3 times as longer every day than you meditate, maybe that balance is not quite to your best interest. Because you see that when you meditate, something very special happens. That gets dimmed. That gets kind of lost in the TV binging. And so there's a decision made. Okay, enough. I'm going to cut back on my TV. I'm going to stop my TV doing it. I'm going to get rid of the TV. So part of this sometimes is making decisions. So there's a very maturing aspect of the spiritual path that we are allowing ourselves to be changed and allowing things to fade, recognizing the fading away and just letting it keep working us and growing and letting these things recede. And when it's appropriate, it's a very mature thing to say, I'm done with that. Enough. I've been playing social games, trying to get everyone to like me or everyone to think of me in a certain way, and trying to prove who I am, because I'm afraid if people find out who I really am, they're not going to like me. So I'm going to preempt it and present, you know, a desirable self. But to see the effort it takes, to see the mental gymnastics involved in this kind of social presentation of self, and the creation of self that goes on, and to really start feeling the pain of it and the stress of it, and starting to get disenchanted with the value of it. And at some point, we might see that that desire that we have around how people see us just fades away and is gone. And they're there in a simple way, kind of like, and sometimes it's a very clear decision, enough. And I think that sounded like a wonderful story that Inez told yesterday of her makeup and dresses and all that. She met the people who didn't do that and they seemed happy. And so she said, I don't have to do it anymore. So I guess that was a decision. Her fading away happened quickly. The fading in, the dying, the way that these desires come in sometimes are not so sudden. But they slowly, slowly build with our conditioning, our social conditioning around us. So we don't see how they slowly develop over time. And that sometimes they become invisible to us, our desires, because it just seems to be part of the fabric of who we think we are, what's supposed to happen. And one of the advantages, the nice things about meditation, is that the quieter the mind can become in meditation, the more we're letting go of the mental constructs that we're living by, the stories we tell ourselves. And one of the functions of getting quiet, really quiet meditation, is not for the sake of being quiet, but to have an experience of well-being, of happiness, of peace, that shows us the discomfort, the suffering, the stress of picking up these stories again, ones that we don't even know we have. And this is sometimes called a deconstruction process. That Vipassana is a deconstruction process where we're slowly deconstructing all our stories, all the ideas of shoulds and shouldn'ts, all the ideas of being good and bad, right and wrong. All the ideas and stories that we live by, and I really mean all ideas, to really simplify. And so that we can maybe have a chance to see some of the subconscious operating systems we operate under, some of the subconscious conditioning that we've received through our life experience. And when it's kind of like one Zen teacher I knew said that meditation was like coming to zero, was his word. And when you're at that zero, then you can watch when you start adding things to that zero. So it's like you're kind of like the idea maybe that you have a blank slate. And then when everything's erased off the slate, you can see what gets added again. So it's a little bit that kind of idea. So as we get quieter, it gives us new information about what new realizations about what we're disenchanted by, what doesn't work, what we don't want to really involve ourselves in again. And then it's useful to have faith. faith in this slow, steady working of the practice without needing to rush, without needing to jump ahead, without causing the Dalai Lama to have to cry again because we're in a hurry. But to just keep practicing with it and seeing it and watching it and breathing and waking up. And then some of this is a very natural process of things fading away and growing and maturing and developing. And the more these attachments fade away, the more they get filled with wholesomeness, with goodness, with wisdom. And then if time comes where it's really clear that it's decision time, don't be afraid of making a wise decision. I've had enough of that. It doesn't serve me anymore. I'm ready to stop. Doesn't mean you can, but it's a very significant thing to make a kind of a real clear acknowledgement statement to yourself. I no longer stand behind this. I'm no longer into it. Yes, my conditioning still operates, but I no longer stand behind it. I no longer want to invest in it or give it authority. And instead, I'm going to have faith and gladness and happiness that I can engage with it, these conditionings of mine, through the practice. I no longer believe this kind of these attachments I have. So now is a time to practice with them. And so we practice with faith, maybe with some gladness, joy. And we, as we do, we discover how to relax, to become tranquil, to find ease